Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 5th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, we've got Martian water signs, frog mating calls, and the dilemmas of teaching climate change science in public schools.
Plus, our usual wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A paper published this week in Science offers some new, tantalizing hints of the possible presence of liquid water on Mars. Analyzing repeat images from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter's HiRISE remote sensing instrument, a team of scientists has zeroed in on dark, linear features that seem to appear and grow on Martian slopes during the warm season and fade when the weather gets colder. One possible interpretation of the markings, says the paper's lead author, Alfred McEwen, is the seasonal flow of liquid, salty water. He talked with me about it from his office in Tucson, Arizona.
This started off as an undergraduate student project. A student came to me and wanted a project, and so we had these stereo images where what we have to do with MRO is take two images on two different orbits with different angles to get our stereo. And on some of these, they were taken quite a long time apart in time, like up to a Mars year, which if we don't get it quickly, we have to wait until the sun and the illumination comes back to about the same conditions to get a good stereo pair. So I asked him, well, the surface may have changed in that time. There could have been rocks rolling down the hill, gullies, or something going on. So he did a project of change detection where you first rectify the images and so forth. And he discovered these small-scale features that we had never seen before.
And how are you getting this information? Are these images?
This is entirely from remote sensing data, primarily HiRISE. These are very small-scale features, only a meter wide in many cases. So the high-resolution imaging science experiment on Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter gets observations with a pixel scale of around 30 centimeters, about a foot per pixel. So that's the only remote sensing instrument that can fully resolve these features. But we are using other remote sensing data as well in trying to understand these.
And can you tell me a little bit more about the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter?
Sure. MRO has been orbiting Mars since 2005, began its primary science phase late in 2006 after aerobraking, and it's been a great mission. We finished the prime mission. We're in an extended mission now. It's in a circular polar orbit, contains a suite of instruments, and what's really nice about MRO is that it has a lot of pointing flexibility, so we can point the spacecraft the left or to the right. That makes it much easier with HiRISE, which only sees a little area at very high resolution, to repeatedly image spots on the surface to monitor changes over time.
And how frequently are you receiving these images?
We're imaging every day. The number of images depends on the data rate and the science targets and so forth, but now is the low data rate period, so we're getting on the order of 6 to 8 images per day.
There are a lot of other topographic features on Mars. You mentioned gullies. There are also ravines and small channels, all these things you mentioned in your paper. What initially piqued your interest about these slope features?
These recurring slope lineae are, first of all, just albedo features, just dark features. We can't see any topography. There may be some topography, but it's below the resolution even of HiRISE. So they're just sort of dark streaks that form, and we have a series of images watching these things grow and fade over time. But we can't see the topography. We can see their association with topography. They flow around obstacles. They don't leave any deposits. They often do follow small channels, which would be called gullies. Now, most of the features on Mars called gullies are features on Earth we call ravines. They're quite big, much, much bigger than these features.
And so what are the key features of these RSL that really indicate to you that they were formed by water?
Okay, nothing. That's the problem. We have no direct evidence that it's water. We've looked for evidence of that with the spectrometer on MRO, and it has an 18 meter per pixel scale, so it doesn't resolve these. But water has very strong absorption bands. Problem is, water flows on the surface of Mars today, it boils. It very rapidly evaporates to the atmosphere and freezes at some depth. So unless you catch this right when it's active, and that's probably a very small area, you wouldn't expect to see the water. So we have no direct confirmation of being water. Instead, it's inference based on all the characteristics we see suggest it's a volatile, the temperatures are right for this to be briny water.
And are we talking about a big flow, a babbling brook? What kind of water do you think there is?
We don't know how much water it could be if it's, you know, just sort of typical flows of water that are just enough to make these features. We're talking about a few liters to a few tens of liters per feature. But it could also be that the water wets the soil and then makes little debris flows. And then it could be even less water, just enough to sort of reduce the friction between the grains so that they flow. We don't know which of those is the case.
And you mentioned something about this water possibly being below the surface?
Yes, some of the flow is probably below the surface. And we see some of these features that are detached. So a streak will not be continuous, but have segments to it. So this is suggestive of subsurface flow. And that also is a lot more stable in terms of flowing further and longer and so forth to be just a little bit under the surface. We don't understand the origin of the water, by the way. There are several possibilities. It could be groundwater. It could be ground ice that melts. It could be ground ice that sublimates and then is actually absorbed by the salts, deliquescence. Or it could be atmospheric water absorbed by salts, even though not clear you can get enough water that way to explain these features. We don't really understand that.
So you also in your paper mentioned a number of alternative explanations for the formation of this and of other features on Mars. Can you talk about a few of those?
Sure. We are trying to do our due diligence to consider multiple working hypotheses, especially for something like this where we don't have any direct evidence of what's doing this. And we picked the name recurring slope lineae to be a totally descriptive name that doesn't assume the origin. So what else could do this? We know that there's an association with warm for Mars temperatures and also rapidly changing temperatures. So just fluctuating the temperature rapidly, that can damage rocks and cause bits and pieces to flake off. But it's a very slow process, and this is a fast process, and doesn't explain how these things darken and then fade again over time.
And when you say warm for Mars, you're actually referring to temperatures that are probably still very cold here on Earth, right?
Temperatures do actually range up above the freezing point of water. But in some cases, we've seen this activity where the temperatures can be as much as, say, 20 degrees below the freezing point for pure water. Briny water, though, can have a much lower melting point. And any water flowing on Mars or under the surface of Mars should be briny because the surface is just salty. We found that from all of the past landers and Martian meteorites and also orbital remote sensing.
You mentioned that as for right now, you can't really explain why these RSL change color seasonally or what gives rise to this change in color. Do you have any hypotheses that you're trying to work with?
Sure. First of all, they don't change color. They just change brightness. And that's actually a clue that may be important. If it was some unique material flowing over different background terrains, it ought to have a different color. Instead, it seems to have the color of the background, only darker. But it does darken somewhat gradually, then fade gradually, then fade away completely in the coldest time of year. So the first idea that occurred to us was that it's darker because it's wet. This wet soil with water, it gets darker. And then as it dries up, it fades. So that seemed like a nice, simple explanation, except CRISM doesn't see any water, and there shouldn't be water there, except very briefly. It should just very rapidly evaporate or freeze in the subsurface. Now, darkening is something you can do in other ways, such as just by roughening the surface or making the grain size larger, so wash away the fine grain. That's not too hard to explain. Why it fades again is more difficult to explain, and it doesn't seem to be from dust deposition because it happens so fast, and certain individual lineae fade much more rapidly than one right next to it, and things like that. It doesn't make sense with dust. One idea, and this wasn't in the paper, but a paper was published just very recently since we finalized this, of actually pouring water on slopes under Martian temperatures and pressures. And what happens is the water freezes in the shallow subsurface. And then they stopped the experiment, and they didn't measure the brightness, but it could be that when it fades, when it sublimates, it could then change the surface texture and cause the brightening. That's an idea that can be tested, at least in the laboratory.
Other than this experiment of pouring water on these slopes, what else do you think that you can do moving forward?
Well, I think more laboratory experiments will really help a lot. And actually now, with these features described, you can design the experiment to test more specific hypotheses, in particular the darkening and fading of these features. Also, we'll keep observing with MRO, and we've just for a few months been getting these very detailed observations of time, and so the more of that we get, the better, and we will be doing some modeling with the topography of exactly what the temperatures are when these are active, and that provides further clues. And we're acquiring better observations with the CRISM spectrometer as well, including a super resolution mode, which gives higher spatial resolution, at least in one dimension. And if they observe at different times of the year, they might be able to pull out some signal there. So we're pursuing multiple lines of research to understand these. I'm optimistic because we do have lots of specific clues here.
Alfred McEwen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie. It's been my pleasure.
Alfred McEwen is the lead author of a new paper documenting recurring slope lineae on the Martian surface.
Next, we move from the Martian surface to something a bit earthier, the signals that drive mating and reproduction on our own planet. Karin Akre and colleagues looked at the problem of why the elaborate signals and displays that male animals use to tempt females eventually reach a limit, rather than evolving to become ever more elaborate. The answer, their work suggests, lies in the basic cognitive limits of the signal recipient. She spoke with me about the work from her office in Austin, Texas.
Nature is full of beautiful and elaborate dances and songs and all kinds of traits because females prefer to mate with males that have really elaborate traits. So there's this question about what is it that ever limits this increasing elaboration? And there's a few ways to answer that, but traditionally people think, well, predators are also attracted to conspicuous traits, and so predation is the limiting factor. But our research shows that also females themselves can be a limiting factor because they depend on their ability to discriminate between different traits, and there are some cognitive limitations to this process.
So I guess in a way this is kind of the peacock's tail with a bit of a twist, not why is the tail so long, but how long can it possibly get?
Yeah, what stops the tail from getting longer and longer and longer?
And I guess the underlying theme of the work, or at least something that you cite in the paper, is something called Weber's Law. Could you briefly set the context by telling me what that is?
Sure. So Weber's Law is this rule that comes from psychophysics. And psychophysics measures how we translate the actual physical magnitude of a stimulus into the perceived magnitude of a stimulus. And that actually doesn't line up in a linear fashion. So Weber's Law states that individuals, when they compare the magnitude of different stimuli, they're using the proportional rather than the absolute differences between those stimuli. And I can give you an example. So if you are holding two weights and you want to know which weight is heavier, and you have a 1-pound weight and a 2-pound weight, it's pretty easy. But if you are holding two weights that are, say, like 50 pounds and 51 pounds, the absolute difference is the same, just 1 pound. But it's much harder because the proportional difference is much smaller.
All right, well, let's shift from balancing weights in one hand or the other to the actual work that you did. You focused on a particular species of frog, the Tungara frog of Central America. Why that species?
Yes, it is called the Tungara frog. And it was a really good species for this study because of their mating behavior and their communication system, which is really well established. And what they do is males go out at night and they advertise for females to come mate with them by vocalizing. And their vocalizations are these calls that can vary. And they have this variety that can include a lot of different components. And so they can get more and more elaborate. So all of the calls start out with this simple element called a whine, and it sounds like toom. And then they can add components called chucks to that whine. So a whine with a chuck sounds like toonga, or a whine with a bunch of chucks sounds like toonga da 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 da.
Hence the name.
Yes, exactly. And the females prefer to mate with the males that produce the elaborate calls. So you would think that the males would just add more and more and more of these chucks forever, but they don't. So it's a really good system to look at to figure out why they stop this elaboration at some point.
And so how did you set up an experiment to answer that?
Well, we went out and we captured frogs in the wild, and we brought them back to the lab where we could test them. And we put females one at a time into this chamber, this acoustic chamber that doesn't let in any light or any sound. And we put the female in the center of the chamber, and then there were two speakers, one on either end of the chamber. And each speaker played a different frog vocalization, one of the male calls. And she could approach the call that she was most attracted to. And so we did a number of these tests with a variety of different females. And then what we did is we predicted how they would respond if they did follow Weber's Law. and then compared that to the way that they actually responded when they were given a choice between calls that varied in different numbers of checks.
And so what was the result?
So females really closely matched the predictions of Weber's Law. So it looks like they really are constrained in their ability to discriminate between the number of checks in these calls as there are more and more checks in the call.
And I was struck, actually, you alluded to this earlier in our chat. I was struck by the fact that you looked not only at what the frogs were doing, but at how their main predators were reacting as well. These were these bats?
Yes. The bats are really interesting because they approach these frog vocalizations as well, but for a totally different reason. They want to eat the frogs. And so we included them in the study for a couple reasons. First of all, if the bats just always preferentially attack the male that makes more chucks, then the bats are going to be the limiting factor in why Tungur frogs don't just forever add more and more chucks.
I see. So in other words, you need to discriminate between the cognitive limitations of the females and this sort of selective pressure of the bats.
Exactly, exactly. And then there was another reason to include the bats as well, and that is that it's possible that the females show this behavior where they're matching the predictions of Weber's Law just by chance, that they're actually choosing the males based on some quality that also varies according to the number of chucks that they make, and that scale would just coincidentally match up with Weber's Law. But the bats also show the same behavior, and the quality of a frog, as determined by the perspective of a bat who's eating that frog, would be very different than the quality as determined by a female who's going to mate with that frog. And so the fact that both the bats and the frogs show the same response and they translate the physical to the perceived magnitude of these stimuli along the same scale is very hard to explain by a shared quality of the male. And so it's much more parsimonious to say that they have a shared cognitive biology that's determining their response pattern.
Okay, so if I understand the work correctly, you've zeroed in then on a case where cognitive capabilities form a sort of a boundary condition for evolution, or at least for the evolution of behavior in this system. What do you think are the next steps in this area?
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on right now in applying an understanding of animal cognition to understanding the evolution of behavior in general, including animal communication. So it's kind of a hot topic now. Specifically for Weber's Law, I think it's going to be really helpful for understanding decision-making in all kinds of contexts within behavioral ecology. And specifically within signal evolution, it's going to be really exciting to see if this can explain how signal innovation evolves. And innovation is different than elaboration because innovation is adding an entirely new signal component to a suite of signals. And if this work applies to as many cases as we think that it might, it could really explain why animals would bother innovating new signals rather than just continuing to elaborate the signals that they currently make.
Karin Akre, thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Karin Akre is the lead author of a new science paper on the evolution of mating signals. In a News Focus article this week, Science's Sarah Reardon reports on how the national political debate over climate change is starting to seep into science classrooms, and how teachers are feeling the heat. Here's Sarah Reardon.
So we're all familiar with the century-long debate over whether evolution or creationism should be taught in grade schools and high schools to children. But because of the political debate that's going on today, it's very loud, it integrates every part of the media over whether or not climate change is occurring and how attributable it is to human activity. Grade school and high school teachers are now finding parents coming to them and saying, you shouldn't be teaching climate change to our students because it's not a science, it's not scientifically based. And there have even been cases where administrators and school boards have told teachers not to teach climate change, that it's an unsettled area of science.
The old teach the controversy thing.
Exactly.
And well, how widespread of an issue are we talking about here? Is this just a few school districts or is this something much broader?
Well, like creationism, it's very difficult to know what any given teacher in any given classroom is saying. And that comes to me from the National Center for Science Education, which has been looking at creationism for many, many years and trying to keep it out of the classroom. What I do know is that I sent out emails to the National Science Teachers Association listserv and got back dozens and dozens of responses from teachers who have said that they had heard of cases where colleagues were being told not to teach climate change, where they'd had parents coming into their classrooms furious, or even a few cases where school boards had voted that teachers have to present both sides of the controversy.
You mentioned parents, and presumably there are other players as well. What are some of the tactics that climate change deniers are using to stir this up?
Well, there are climate change deniers and there's climate change skeptics who just think that there are two sides that are being unequally presented, despite the fact that 97% of scientists in the U.S. believe that climate change is caused by human activity. And so one of the things that's been happening is some of these people will suggest maybe you should have a debate. You should have a climate denier and a climate scientists get up on stage in front of students and talk about the pros and cons, which has a lot of scientists and educators concerned because that's not the way that science works. Science works through peer review and through reaching a consensus based on data, not through who has the louder voice. There's a case in Los Alamitos in Southern California in Orange County. It's a conservative area just a couple months ago. The school board there decided they didn't like the idea of climate change being presented in a high school classroom in an advanced placement class. And so they passed a new mandate saying that teachers were going to have to present evidence every year of how they were going to talk about both sides of the debate.
It's interesting. You mentioned pressure from several different directions coming on teachers. I must admit, my heart kind of goes out to these high school teachers. I imagine dealing with this sort of thing just adds up to a huge unfunded mandate for them.
Well, sure. Many of these teachers, I mean, whether they're earth science teachers, environmental science teachers, or just general science teachers, it may have been many years since they've had science education. Climate change is something that's very rapidly changing, and it's very hard to keep up with. The last thing that they need when they're often struggling with this very complex science themselves is people coming in and saying, you're teaching us wrong. You need to be teaching all of these other positions that may or may not be actually based in science and more based in policy.
And sometimes I guess this isn't exactly a grassroots thing. It's not just concerned parents. There are some well-heeled external groups involved as well.
Yeah, there have been several think tanks and other climate skeptic groups that have been sending out videos and handbooks to teachers that may or may not be based in science, but seem very legitimate, that cast doubt on the scientific consensus that climate change is occurring. And there have even been several state laws that have passed, one particularly in Louisiana, that talks mostly about evolution, giving teachers the right to question evolution in class without fear of reprisal. But they also list climate change after that as another issue that teachers can question.
Well, some of the issues regarding the teaching of evolution have kind of played out in the courts. Is there any such remedy for climate change teaching as well?
It doesn't seem likely from the people I've talked to that teachers would have a lot of recourse there. The reason that creationism has been shut down time and time again in the courts is that it's been ruled that it's a religious stance. And under the First Amendment, you can't present religion in a public school. But climate change is not couched in religion.
Okay, well, if the courts aren't available, where is this headed? What can the scientific community do in response to this?
Well, a lot of the science education organizations are very cognizant that this is happening. And even agencies such as NOAA and USGS and some of the others that deal with climate change, NASA, have set up workshops where teachers can come and learn more about climate change, do hands-on projects, even go out in the field with climate scientists and learn how to really be very sure of their own grounding so that then when they encounter teachers or administrators or skeptical students, they can present, look, this is what these very well-known scientists say. At the same time, that doesn't necessarily prepare them in the same way to deal with these attacks that teachers have been trying to teach evolution for years have been dealing with. So there have been several other educational organizations that are specifically trying to take what they've learned from many years of fighting the teaching of creationism and reapply that to fighting denial of climate change.
Sarah Reardon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Reardon writes about the politics of teaching climate change in U.S. classrooms in a news focus in this week's Science.
Finally today, Natalie Villacorta, writer for Science, is here with some of the latest stories from our daily news site. First up, we've got some illuminating research about calculating risk in basketball.
Right. So the first story we have here is on the mathematics of basketball. Basically, a new paper came out the other day that's looking at when the best time to take aim is.
So where did the idea for this paper come from?
Well, Brian Skinner, the author of this paper, he's actually a grad student at the University of Minnesota in theoretical physics. In 2007, he went to a talk at the American Physical Society meeting, and he heard a talk about the flow of traffic. The ideas he heard about this traffic inspired him and kind of reminded him of a theory that he'd heard about basketball.
So he actually created an analogy between traffic and basketball.
That's right, yeah. So at the meeting, they were talking about how the average driver, when they're driving, they're really trying to reduce their own personal time, not the average time of every driver out on the road. And this reminded him of a theory in basketball named after Patrick Ewing, who was a high-scoring player for the New York Knicks. Analysts had noticed that when Ewing or other big scorers sat out on the bench, the team actually was more likely to win.
And so he wanted to investigate why this actually is.
That's right. So last year, he published a paper showing that virtually every equation from traffic theory could be applied to basketball, which is pretty cool. So what he's doing in this new paper is trying to predict when the best time to take a shot is. And his findings are pretty surprising.
Can you name a few of those findings?
Sure. One of the more obvious findings is that the more seconds that are left on the clock, for example, NBA teams have 24 seconds to possess the ball before they need to shoot. And in men's college basketball, you have 35 seconds. So the more seconds that are left on the clock, the choosier a player should be, and they should pass up all the shots except for the highest quality ones.
Okay, so that one's relatively intuitive. Were there others that were a little bit more surprising?
Right. So if you think about two teams, A and B, both of which have the same chance of scoring, the same ball turnover rate, and the same number of seconds left on the clock to shoot, but Team A is twice as fast as passing as Team B, you'd probably think that Team A should shoot twice as fast as Team B. Say, Team A would shoot every 10 seconds if Team B is shooting every 20 seconds. But what Skinner actually found out is that Team A should shoot every 13 seconds, 3 seconds longer than what you might actually think, giving them a few more seconds to be selective about what shots to make.
So in essence, he's saying that taking a little bit more time is actually really beneficial to you in the long term.
That's right.
Now, on paper, these results are great. How easy do you think they're actually going to be to implement in the game?
Well, apparently basketball coaches and managers are more receptive than they've ever been before to putting these models into practice. The problem is that Skinner actually hasn't been able to get his hands on any data from professional teams yet.
All right. Well, I'll look forward to seeing how this works out.
Yeah, the next time you're on the court, think about whether you're shooting too often or not often enough, and what the other players, whether they're good or bad, should be doing.
Next up, we've got a story about how vampire bats have evolved to detect warm-blooded meals.
Right, so vampire bats are pretty nasty creatures. Not only do they suck the blood of cows, but also suck human blood. So watch out the next time your toe's poking out from underneath your covers.
Now, vampire bats have to feed on what sounds like an enormous amount of blood to survive.
Yeah, they actually consume 70 to 80% of their body weight in blood almost every night.
Now, how exactly do they locate the meals to get this much blood?
Researchers located this ion channel called the TRPV1. Normally, this channel stimulates sensory neurons that are activated in response to painful heat.
And so this gene is what's responsible for that tingly feeling when you've eaten something really spicy.
This is correct. But in vampire bats, the version of this ion channel has actually been truncated through an alternative splicing of the TRPV1 gene. So what's interesting is that in other animals, 40 degrees Celsius threshold is required to activate these channels. But researchers found after they inserted the genetic instructions for this shortened TRPV1 channel into frog egg cells, that the threshold for this shortened version of the channel is 31 degrees Celsius, which is 9 degrees lower than the threshold required to activate the longer version found in other animals.
So bats can, in essence, detect bodies that are slightly cooler than what they otherwise would have been able to detect.
That's right. Vampire bats have adapted this channel to be activated at the temperature of warm-blooded animals and human blood.
So does this mean that when a bat lands on warm prey, its nose actually tingles?
I'm not quite sure about that, but the researchers did find that these shortened channels are only in the bats' faces, not found in nerves located in other parts of their body.
All right, well, no pain, no gain, I guess.
Right. The researchers should bring in Dracula and see whether he's got these sensors in his chin.
Okay, and lastly today, scientists have been chiseling away at an explanation for why the moon has such a dramatic geography.
So the biggest question in lunar science was, what's the origin of Earth's moon? But now that we know that the Earth was formed from debris that splashed off the Earth from an enormous impact, the biggest question is, why does the moon have its two-sided geology?
So by two-sided geology, you're referring to the fact that one half of the moon is pretty flat, pretty low-lying, but the other one is more mountainous?
That's right. The side that profiles the man or the woman on the moon is relatively flat, whereas on the other side, the terrain is very mountainous. This has puzzled scientists for a while.
And so what do they think happened?
Impact modelers from the University of California, Santa Cruz proposed that perhaps this dichotomous terrain was created by an impact.
An impact on the low-lying side or the mountainous side?
Well, the scientists think that the impact actually occurred on the mountainous side of the moon.
So that's unusual. We usually think of impacts resulting in craters. How could one actually result in creating mountains?
Well, that's a question that the researchers were faced with when they were creating this model. The scientists realized that if the cause was an impact, it was going to have to be a very slow-moving impactor. Because as you mentioned, otherwise a crater would have formed, not a mountainous terrain.
Oh, very interesting. And so how could they explain that?
What they're proposing is that the debris that created our moon also created a smaller sister moon, a third of the size of our moon. What they think happened is that the sister moon, moving at a little more than a tenth of the speed of usual impactors, splattered onto the mountainous side. The reason why mountainous terrain was created instead of a crater is because of this extremely slow-moving sister moon. So you can kind of think of it like throwing mud against a wall.
So step by step, what would have happened when these two bodies collided?
So what happened in the collision is that magma that was in the magma ocean, still lingering beneath the lunar crust, was squished over to the near side, the flat side that has the profile of the man or the woman in the moon. So it's thought that the heat generated from this magma could have created the dark lavas on the lunar maria.
And what kind of feedback have these scientists gotten so far?
Scientists don't think that this is a crazy idea, but it's important to keep in mind that these are just models. There's no hard evidence. And it'll actually have an opportunity to be tested when NASA's Gravity Recovery and Interior Laboratory mission, which is scheduled to be launched in September, probes the lunar interior, and it should return some of the most sensitive measurements of lunar gravity that has ever been made.
All right, so what other exciting science news do we have this week?
So we've got a shot on an extremely rare disease in which people do not actually have fingerprints. This disease is called achromatoglyphia, and it's also referred to as immigration delay disease because individuals with the disease, there's actually only been 4 known families ever documented with this disease. Individuals who are affected with this disease report having difficulty crossing borders.
Oh, wow. So what were scientists researching in this case?
They were trying to figure out what the mutation is that causes this rare disorder, and they pinpointed one mutation that they think is the cause of this unusual disease. Another exciting story we have going on for Science Now this week is a very exciting discovery. Researchers from Kyoto University have found a way to turn mouse embryonic stem cells into sperm. So when these cells were transplanted into mice that were unable to produce sperm normally, the stem cell-derived primordial germ cells produced normal-looking sperm, which were then used to successfully fertilize eggs.
Does this process have the potential for being used in humans later on?
I think it's too early to tell, but they did show that the fertilized eggs, when transplanted into a recipient mother, produced healthy offspring that grew into fertile male and female adult mice. In the future, this could really help out couples who are unable to have children right now.
Absolutely.
Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat about the hottest topics in science, we'll be talking about the future of stem cell research. This topic has come up after last week's ruling in Shirley versus Sibelius that federally funded research on human embryonic stem cells is legal. The ruling ends 11 months of uncertainty about whether human stem cell research supported by the National Institutes of Health would suddenly be shut down. Please join us at 3 p.m. on Thursday for a live chat to discuss what's next with Shirley versus Sibelius and what it's like to work in a research field where the rules are always changing.
Natalie Villacorta is a writer for Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the August 5th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.